is the legend, one with clout. King of kings, 40's larger than life. A bullwhip cracking, slicing through strife. Bo James, the king.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode one of the Bo James Show here on the Outlaws to Independence Network. Let me tell you what this program will be. It is not replacing Outlaws to Independence. That is going to continue with John and I. It's just this will be a program that will be semi-regular where I'll come on and talk about things that I can't talk about on the Outlaws to Independence. That is covering Outlaws and Independence. Here I can talk about territories. I can talk about Appalachian history. I can talk about current news, you know, in the world of wrestling. Just something that I can do away from the Outlaws to Independence. And I can also drop that in like this month where John and I were only able to do one program together. And we're looking forward to doing the August Outlaws to Independence. We will be answering your questions. And if you have questions for John and I, please drop them on the Outlaws to Independence Facebook page. That way I can keep them all there, because before I was taking them on every form of our platforms on social media, and we missed a few. So if we keep it to the Facebook page, or you can email it, and the email is in the description. That way I make sure that we don't miss any of them. Want to talk about where I have been here recently. I was in Waterloo, Iowa, part of the George Tragos Lou Thesz Hall of Fame. I got to speak on East Tennessee wrestling history. I was limited by time, so I gave cliff notes of the history of the territory. I dove more into Ron and Whitey like we're going to do on this program here today. But it was great having so many people come early on a Friday morning to listen and learn about East Tennessee wrestling history. And they have already asked me to come back and speak again next year. So I will have a new subject. We're playing with the Welch family is what I will talk about next year, and their importance on pro wrestling, not only in Tennessee, but all the surrounding states and the southeastern United States, and how important that family is to the history. There's something like 36 or 37 of them that either promoted, booked, headlined, or owned territories. There's no other family like them in the history of wrestling, and they're a very interesting subject. My heroes, many of them, Ron Fuller, Robert Fuller, Jimmy Golden, growing up watching them and getting to be friends with them in life. It, you know, it's just something cool about my wrestling career and how blessed my life is. So I'm working on that, and it may change over the next year, but I'll keep you updated on this and on my Patreon and on Outlaws to Independence. Patreon.com/KingofKingsport. The subject today is Ron and Whitey, fact versus fiction. And the audio that you will be hearing from that comes from my Patreon from 5 years ago, November of 2020. I did a special Patreon on them, and I'm going to drop it here today for you because it's a very interesting subject, especially if you grew up in the Tri-Cities, Mountain Empire area, my home region, or if you've just become fascinated with Ron and Whitey through the internet and everything else over the years. You're going to learn quite a bit about them today, as people learned quite a bit about them in Waterloo, Iowa last week. I was going to drop this program on Thursday, and that was the day that Hulk Hogan died, and I had already recorded all this. This opening that you're hearing, I've went back and recorded tonight, and I went back and forth with, should I keep with Ron and Whitey, or should I do something on Hogan? But I'm still working on the notes and stuff for Hogan in his short time in East Tennessee with Southeastern Wrestling and his time in Memphis and Mobile. So I will do that very soon, either drop it here or drop a Patreon about that. I didn't realize how big of an effect Hogan had on my life until Thursday when he passed away. I was a diehard NWA fan. I was not a WWF fan. I was telling a friend last night as we were talking about it, every week when I would see a new Mid-Atlantic guy or Tennessee guy show up on the WWF TV, I would be mad about it. Because I knew I would not get to see them live. I wanted them to stay here. I wanted to keep them in my wrestling, you know. But Hogan, everybody in the sport of wrestling owes a debt to Hulk Hogan over the years. Randy Hales did a podcast, Randy Hales Show, that's on his YouTube and on his Facebook. I also shared it on my Facebook. He put together a program that night. I was in the second hour of it. Michael St. John is on there. Michael is the guy that did the voiceover for the first Hulk Hogan vignette. Wasn't even Hulk Hogan yet. He was just the Hulk. And Michael and Randy West put that together, and it played for a few weeks before Hogan got here to Tennessee. They showed it in Memphis first. That's where it was created. Then they showed it in Knoxville. I have vivid memories of seeing it as a child. And Michael gives his input on how that was created, how it came about in the process of doing that. So check that out over on Randy's Facebook page or his YouTube. Just type in Randy Hales Wrestling on YouTube. Also here, not this coming week, but next week, I believe, I will be back on Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw, as we recorded that this week, and we talk West Virginia history. And if you think East Tennessee wrestling history is wild, just wait till you hear what John and Mr. Briscoe and I talk about on their podcast. Fascinating, interesting, and Jan Madrid is the biggest carny that was ever in the wrestling business, and I give you several examples of proof of that on their show. So looking forward for that to come out and the feedback that I will get for that once it's out. Real fast, before we get to Ron and Whitey, fact versus fiction. As I've said on the other podcast, Outlaws to Independence, there is a lot of time and a lot of research that goes into everything that I do. Whether it's Outlaws to Independence, whether it's my Patreon, whether it's this program now, whether it's my appearances on Bradshaw to Briscoe. And it's important to me, as I told him in Waterloo, as we speak their names, we keep them alive. As we spread the history, we keep them alive. If we take a look at them, deep dive, as they say now, as we're going to do here just in a moment, we keep the history alive. And Don Wright said to me in the dressing room right after Ron passed, he said, as long as you and I are alive, Ron and Whitey are alive. It's their memory. And they are men that need to be remembered, not only for professional wrestling, but the men that they were. Today, as I record this, is the 50th anniversary of a huge card in Kingsport. I put that on Pro Wrestler Bo James' Facebook. And it was a card that Ron Wright promoted. It's a card that he put together to help Ed Wolf, who had lost his leg in a mishap weeks earlier, where Ed had been thrown out of the ring. In a match in Johnson City, he landed on a wooden chair. The wooden chair broke. The leg of the chair went through his thigh. And it, because of fault of the doctor, an infection came along. It's a big part of my 70s book that will be coming out, because it's such a tragedy. First, Whitey is killed in 72. His protege was Ed Wolf, and Ed was getting, as people told me, to where you could really have a match with him, and he could really be a main event guy, and they had big plans for him. And that's when this came about, and he was the last connection other than Ron and Don to Whitey left in East Tennessee. So it was a big blow to the wrestling fans who had started coming back after Whitey had died to cheer on Ed Wolf. And Ron Wright and Don Wright were baby faces at this point, and they were, you know. And now they had this tragedy. But Ron put together a huge card, and it drew like 1,500 to 1,800 people, and all the money went to Ed Wolf to help him adjust to life after having his leg amputated. That's the kind of guy that Ron Wright was. That's the kind of guy that Don Wright is. That's the kind of man that Whitey Caldwell was. They're special parts not only to my home region. They're special parts not only to the profession that I've called mine for 35 plus years, but they are a special part of my life. And I didn't know Whitey. He passed almost 2 years before I was born, but thank God I've got to know Ron and Don Wright through the years and hear these stories firsthand and research them and sit with them and talk to them. And that's why I do this, because they're important parts of what I do. And without them, I would have never been able to do what I have done in my life. And I owe a debt to not only them, but everybody that worked with them and worked for them after they had owned the territory. And you'll hear about that in today's podcast. I'm looking forward to hearing your feedback. Thank you guys for listening. John and I will be back in August, hopefully with two Outlaws of the Independence. May just be one. John's got a lot going on in life. Nothing bad. All positive. It's not my place to tell you what it is. Hopefully he'll tell you on the next podcast, but I'll tell you I'm happy as I can be for John Boucher, my friend, and I can't wait to he shares the news with everybody and we all can be happy for him. But let's talk about it. Fact versus fiction. Ron Wright versus Whitey Caldwell. I obviously never met Whitey Caldwell. He passed away 2 years before I was born in a horrific car wreck that took his life way too young. But I've known many people that known Whitey Caldwell. Wrestling fans, wrestlers, Whitey's family. I knew Whitey's widow Nancy very well. I know his children. I know his grandchildren. Ron and Don Wright, Les Thatcher, Frank Morrell, people like that I've heard talk about Whitey Caldwell. Other people that would surprise you. When I met Ed Wazowski out in Portland, Oregon many years ago and he found out where I was from, that was the first thing he asked me, if I knew Whitey Caldwell, because he had worked with Whitey very early in his career, passing through Tennessee. So Whitey left an impact and an impression on everybody. Now I want to tell you a few things that I know about Whitey from my research. Whitey Caldwell's name was in the newspaper quite a bit, long before he was ever a professional wrestler. The local sports page had his name with his pitching and baseball playing. They talked about him going to the state tournament for Golden Gloves, something he picked up because they needed somebody at the boys' club to fit the weight division. And he had never thought about it, had never did it, picked the boxing up, trained for only a few weeks, and ended up going all the way to the state tournament. So he was an athlete. I went to church with my home church, Calvary Baptist Church in Kingsport. It is in the neighborhood that Whitey grew up, just a couple of streets over from where Whitey grew up and where Whitey lived for many years as an adult. And many of the people, some of them have passed on, but they've told me over the years that nobody could outrun Whitey, nobody could outthrow Whitey, nobody could out-wrestle Whitey, nobody could outfight Whitey. Because when it came down to whatever it was, whether it was golf, whether it was baseball, whether it was football, whether it was boxing, Whitey was a natural. And he was an unbelievable athlete at everything that he did. It came natural to him, where a lot of people, Ron Wright being one of them, who had to train a lot harder at wrestling at the boys' club than Whitey. Whitey was a natural athlete. But the thing that I always have taken away from people talking about Whitey, they say what a nice man he was. My cousin, Jerry Charlton, worked with Ron and Don at the Kingsport Press. And his wife, Iva, worked with Whitey at the glass plant for many years in Kingsport. And I remember just a few years ago, before Iva passed away, we were having lunch out here at a local restaurant by my house. And she said, "I don't know how it is now," she said, "but I know when Ron and Whitey were fighting, it was real." Because Whitey would come in to work and he would have stitches in his eye and he'd have big cuts in his head and he'd have black eyes and this and this and this. And she's talking about the cuts in his head, and I just started laughing because she didn't know about the chisel. I did. And I showed her a picture of it and explained to her what it was and how it was used. And she said, "See, I told you, they were doing it for real." So, but she told me, all the years she worked with Whitey at the glass plant, if anybody there was sick, if anybody had lost a loved one, if some kind of tragic event had happened, Whitey would come to that person and ask them, do you need help with anything? Is there anything that I can do for you? And she said he really meant it. And she said he gave money to a lot of people that most people didn't know about to help them out in hard times and help them get through hard times. Because Whitey and Ron were making a very good living wrestling. So was Donnie. There's a misconception. Let's get down to the first fact versus fiction here. There is a misconception that the Wrights and Whitey Caldwell and the other people working this territory, the Kingsport territory, and here's fact versus fiction number two. The Kingsport territory was separate from Knoxville. They did not combine until January of 1975 when Ron Fuller bought Knoxville and he started doing some towns with Ron right up here in the Tri-Cities. So, two different offices. But people think that they were not making money here when they were making a tremendous amount of money in that day and age. There's a letter in the book that I'm taking most of the information you're going to hear about here today that I'm reading to you from. Don't miss this, The History of Pro Wrestling in the City of Kingsport, 1960-69, my book that I put together researching the history of the weekly events in Kingsport and some spot shows around Kingsport. And there's a letter from the Duprees trying to get booked in a bigger territory and leave there. And they say how much money they're making in Kingsport, a small territory where the furthest trip was like the Harlan or Hazard to the north, to the state, North Carolina state line to the south, to Marion, Virginia to the east, to Morristown, Greenville Split to the west. So the furthest trip was less than 130 miles in the territory, and they were making $300 a week in 1967, I think it was, so I'll do the inflation calculator. Guys were making $1,575 a week, guaranteed, in today's money in this little territory, where you probably were not making more than $75 to $90 a week working in a factory or working wherever else you were working. Ron and Whitey made a promise to Bill Caney, their mentor, that they would always keep a job because Bill Caney was the man that helped break them in through Mickey Barnes's office. Bill Caney had a heart attack. He was a top star. He was the Ron Wright of Kingsport in the 40s and 50s. But he had a heart attack in his late 30s or early 40s that ended his career, and he had nothing to fall back on, nothing to help his family. He was down and out for a long time. Then he came back and worked in the office, and he refereed some, but he worked as a night watchman in Kingsport until his death to make sure that he had a guaranteed paycheck. That's why Ron and Whitey and Don had jobs. Not because they weren't making money. They were making a lot of money. I have seen pay stubs, and I've seen payments where they were making $1,500 to $2,000 a week between owning the territory and working as the main event guy and working for John Kazana. So you do the math on that, that's, you know, several thousand dollars a week they were making in today's money. But Whitey was a great guy. He was everything outside of the ring that he portrayed on television and in the ring, because he wasn't playing a character. He wasn't a gimmick. He wasn't an actor. He was a pro wrestler, and this is who I am, this is what I am, and it's one of the reasons that he was so over in these heels. It's one of the reasons that he is so over till this day. People still put flowers on his grave 48 years after he's gone, because they remember him, and they've heard the legends of him, and they've heard the stories of him. And Whitey was very modest. He didn't brag. He didn't like to go out and sell pictures or sell merchandise or do any of that stuff. He just, you know, I'm a guy that's blessed to get to do what I love and make this much money and be on TV and do this and that. The only time that he actually ever went out and sold pictures, he did it in all the towns for a week, because there was a little girl that was a big fan of his in Morristown, and she had a kidney ailment and needed surgery. and Whitey went out and sold pitchers in Kingsport, Johnson City, Morristown, Knoxville, wherever else they were at that week. He made enough money selling his 8x10s that he paid in full for her surgery, plus some money left over to help him get through. That's the kind of man that Whitey Caldwell was. That's the kind of star that Whitey Caldwell was. Could you imagine now if you had a child who needs this life-saving surgery, that you're leaving it up to a man to walk out into these towns and sell 8x10s to make enough money to pay for it? It never happened now. But it happened then. And it's part of the fact of the legend of Whitey Caldwell. Whitey was a great sportsman, a great sports star, a great hero, a great man to look up to. He was an all-around good man, a great father, his children. Some of them were very young when he passed away, but they have great memories of him. People that worked with him, people that knew him from the neighborhood. I've never heard anyone say anything negative about Whitey, bad about Whitey. I've nothing but high praise, love, and respect when you hear Whitey Caldwell's name. Now let's talk about Ron Wright. And more people seem to know more about Ron because there's more video of Ron that survived from Southeastern and Continental and of course, Smoky Mountain and the John Kazana TV that survived over the years. So people have heard Ron and they've seen Ron and they've heard more about Ron and his flying of airplanes and driving cars and, you know, just everything else. And I got to know Ron pretty good over the years. And I first met Ron Wright in 1989 when he came back and did some stuff for Continental. And I got to know him by booking him in some of my towns when I first started running with Wayne Rogers and Don Wright and Tony Peters. And Ron was always very helpful. Ron was always very good. And anything that I would ask him to do, he would do it. And anything that I would need help or advice with, he would think about it and give me advice of how we should do this or that. Or, you know, he was always very good, very helpful to me. But he also was a madman. He kept a book at his job in his locker that I've heard about from people that worked with him that was wrote on the front of it, Diary of a Madman. And he would write stuff in there about wrestling and about different things at his job. And the book got stolen out of his locker. If anybody out there has any idea where that book is at, I would love to see it. I'm sure a lot of people would love to see it. But Ron was straight up hillbilly. So was Donnie. And they proud of it, just like me, just like most people that live here in these mountains. And you're the most hated man in your hometown, and you're the most hated man in your home region. You can't really go out in the public. You really can't go do stuff because people are going to want to try to fight you. People's going to mess with your car. People's going to mess with your family. So they had to come up with ways to entertain themselves. And things that they did, ribbing each other and getting in the plane and scaring people to death and all the different things that they did to entertain themselves. Most people could not have handled it or lived through it. Tony Peters told me a story one time about when they were still building Interstate 81. And you could have to go old road then onto it and you could get on it. And they had found out that they had graveled the road. And they said he's flying up through there one night in the gravel, coming back from Knoxville. And they said, hey, you better be careful in case, you know, we hit a big hole or a big pile of gravel or something. He said, I ain't afraid. They said, when 2 minutes later he hits a pile of gravel and like the Dukes of Hazzard, they go flying through the air. Scares everybody in the car except Ron. He's having the time of his life. Then when they finally finished the interstate, he's coming back from Knoxville driving. And most of the time he would fly from Tri-Cities down there just because it was so much faster. He'd get off work, have to fly down, do TV, and then work that night or whatever. And he would wrestle in Knoxville Friday night, have to be back to work Friday night, work all night, then go back down for Kazana. So he would fly and make it much faster. But he's driving home one night, and they said he got on the new interstate, and he said, "I want to see how fast I can go." And somewhere up a little past Morristown, he got pulled over by the state troopers. And the guy walks up to him and says, "Let me see your pilot's license, because you were flying." And Ron reached right in his wallet and handed him his pilot's license instead of his driver's license. And that didn't get over too well with the cop, but he thought that was funny. Ron came up with the idea of the chisel. And we're going to talk about that chisel here in a few minutes. You have to think of a mindset of a human being that says there has to be an easier way to draw blood out of a man's face than hitting him right in the eye or cutting himself. And he got the concept of this thing, designed it, and had it made, and used it on everybody for years. And made one for his brother, and made one for Tony Peters, and I think Rick Connors has one, you know. So it just, Ron had a different mind than most people in the wrestling business. But Ron was also a very good man. Just like Whitey Caldwell, Ron gave a lot of money to help a lot of people that you never knew about. He did a lot of charity work. He did a lot of wrestling events to help raise money for, you know, people that needed it and charities that needed it, and people didn't realize Ron was the promoter and the boss doing it. They loved their community. Ron and Whitey both loved Kingsport, and they loved these heels around here, that Harlan and Hazard and Pennington Gap, Virginia, and, you know, all these other places, Bean Station, Tennessee, Morristown, Knoxville. They loved this home region. And they were so lucky and so blessed to get to be the stars in their home area. And most people never get that opportunity because they would not push a local guy in a territory. The only other exceptions that I can really think of is Jerry Lawler in Memphis. They would not push local guys unless they were in the family, because if they got over, they were afraid they would run opposition to the main office, or they would get over and they would have their ends with the newspapers and the TVs and everything else, maybe to take it away from them. But Ron and Whitey, and they had to face that. We're going to talk about that here just in a few minutes too. But Ron and Whitey had to face that, but they ended up with a series of matches that people still talk about to this day. People still wonder about this day. People that I witnessed these still have vivid memories of the blood and the guts and the violence. And the toll that these men took on their bodies. And we're going to talk about a quote here in a few minutes that Don Wright gave me about Whitey and how tough he was. But the toll that they gave themselves with the chisels and the hard ways and the chain matches and the travel through these mountains when they weren't flying, when they were driving. And I never heard of Whitey flying anywhere. So he must have drove the whole territory. Which, you know, he didn't have any problems, because if he would have broke down or had any kind of trouble anywhere, everybody knew who he was. They would have helped him out and did whatever they possibly could do for the man. I think that's another reason that Ron and Don flew to like Harlan and Hazard, so they couldn't get caught on the mountain roads leaving town, where the good old boys, the local boys, would be waiting on them. But, you know, these two men have left an impact. They've left a thumbprint on this part of the Appalachian Mountains. And they've left their thumbprint on not only wrestling history, but local mythical history, local history itself. And we're going to go through it right now, because here's another fact versus fiction. People will tell you, "Oh, they wrestle each other all the time. Almost every week they's fighting each other." That is simply not true. They did not fight each other every week. They didn't fight each other every month. They fought each other a few times a year, and sometimes it was years they didn't touch each other. We're going to go through that in a minute, but let's back all the way up. How did these men get started? Well, they started at the Boys Club in Kingsport, Tennessee, which was downtown, and it was started and funded by a local group of businessmen, one of them being local wrestling promoter Mickey Barnes. And the Boys Club had a wrestling team, a boxing team, a baseball team, a football team, plus they had other activities for the kids to do. And Ron and Whitey started, they were on the first wrestling team at the Boys Club. And the first wrestling coach, here's some great history for you, the first wrestling coach at the Boys Club in Kingsport was a young man by the name of Ed Welch. You would know him better as Buddy Fuller, the father of Ron and Robert Fuller. Ed Welch was in here working for his uncle and his granddad, and alongside Mickey Barnes, learning how to run territory, promote towns, and do all that good stuff that you have to do to be successful. Ron and Robert actually lived here as just babies, as children, when Ed was working as a referee and wrestled some and was promoting with Mickey and working at the Boys Club. But that's where Ron and Whitey got started, was down there at the Boys Club. And at the Boys Club, they met another young guy by the name of Buddy Russell, who was a little bit older than them. And Buddy was into boxing and into wrestling, and Buddy actually, years later, would build a lot of rings that were used around here in East Tennessee, and he had one of the first gyms, workout gyms, in the city of Kingsport, and he kind of started taking people out of the Boys Club and started running a little outlaw program, and they were actually even having these little shows at the Boys Club in Kingsport. And Mickey Barnes had went down and watched them a few times. My research shows he was there and was even interviewed by the newspaper about what did he think about these kids. And you could imagine what he thought. You know, here's these, it was pretty much backyard wrestling, except they were in the Boys Club in a ring. They weren't trained, didn't know anything. But somehow, 1958, Buddy got to rent the Civic Auditorium in Kingsport. And he put on a boxing and wrestling event. And the two big draws on this event were Whitey Caldwell and Ron Wright. They were in a tag match, and people came to see them. It drew a house. Mickey Barnes went to see it, to see what was going to happen. And Mickey began to recruit Whitey Caldwell to turn pro and come to work for his territory. And Whitey agreed only if Ron got to come along, because Ron was a big fan and he wanted to be a part of it. Ron was a little bit younger, not as seasoned as an amateur wrestler as Whitey, not as good, and that's his own. Ron and Don both will tell you that Whitey was a tremendous amateur wrestler. So Ron would help put the ring up and referee and get the wrestling spot shows or here or there a little bit when they needed it, or to pacify him and keep him happy and keep Whitey happy, to let Ron do something. And he was known then as Ronald Wright. He had not shortened it to Ron Wright. So you see newspaper clippings, and you'll see it in my book, where he's mentioned as Ronald Wright. The first big break for Whitey came in the summer of 61 as Studio Wrestling came to WJHL Channel 11. Out of Johnson City. Mickey Barnes had a live studio program, and this was the first localized TV wrestling in the Tri-Cities. Before that, you could see the stuff from the Marigold Theater on network TV out of Chicago. You could pick up wrestling from Charlotte because there were so few TV stations and the airwaves were that strong. They went for hundreds of miles. And if you lived in the right place and had the right antenna, you could get Knoxville wrestling for a short time when they had it in the late 50s. But now here you've got localized TV, and they're trying to figure out who's watching this thing. How are we, you know, what towns are we reaching? Where do we need to go run? So they did something that's as old as TV wrestling. Georgia Championship Wrestling did this to find out who was watching where on cable TV when the cable went across the country. That's why they went to Ohio and Michigan and West Virginia, because that's where they were getting the most mail from. So they said, we're going to crown the TV champion, the first TV champion here for Channel 11. And here's how we're going to crown it. You write in and say who's the most popular wrestler. Whoever we elect, whoever's elected the most popular wrestler will be the first television champion. Well, they started getting letters almost overnight from all around the Tri-Cities. And the Mountain Empire, Southwest Virginia, part of North Carolina, part of Kentucky, East Tennessee. So, they're kind of shocked that Whitey Caldwell, who had only been really used in preliminary matches, he would win some, lose some, but he was a draw. They knew that. They knew people, but they were shocked that people were writing in from all over that Whitey Caldwell is my favorite wrestler. Whitey's our hero. Whitey's this and that. And as a shoot, they had to, so many people wrote in, they had to say Whitey was the TV champion. So Whitey is starting to get his first push and his first break. He is still not the top guy. He's behind Sam Steamboat on the TV because Sam was a bigger star, not from here, you know, had a big track record of drawing money. So Whitey's starting to get pushed. He's not in the towns every week. He's not, but he's winning. And he's the TV champion. And he's getting to do interviews. And people are falling in love with this guy. People want to be this guy. Here's Whitey Caldwell, this local boy. Man, look how good he's doing for himself. So we get through the summer and we're going into the fall, and Whitey's starting to catch fire where he's really starting to get over because now he's got some wins. He's got some wins over different people. And we get to November the 29th, 1961. Advertised card. Pat O'Connor against Herb Larson in the main event. Former world champion Pat O'Connor against Herb Larson. Lester Welch and Tiny Smith. Tiny Smith is a team with Lester against Flash Gordon and Red Roberts. Tiny Smith is Jake the Snake Roberts' dad. It's Grizzly Smith, who had came in and out of this territory many times. So that's the advertised card. Pat O'Connor, one of the biggest stars in the world, going to draw a big house. And the next morning, the Kingsport headlines are not about Pat O'Connor. They're about Ron Wright and Whitey Caldwell. The headline for November 30th, 1961, in the Kingsport Times News, wrestlers require medical attention. Ronald Wright and Whitey Caldwell required medical attention after bruising first match last night on the weekly wrestling program at the Civic Auditorium. Wright sustained a gash alongside his eye, which required 6 stitches to close, while Caldwell received a dislocated shoulder but managed to win the match. Red Roberts and Flash Gordon were awarded the decision over Herb Larson and Tiny Smith in the main event. No explanation why O'Connor was not there, why the card was changed, or anything else. They were last-minute substitutions in front of a big house at the Civic Auditorium. This was Ron and Whitey's first chance to shine as local boys in a real match. This is Ron Wright's first featured match. He had been part-time wrestler, mostly referee up until this point. They've been roughhousing with each other since they were kids. During the match, Whitey hardways Ron. Ron gets mad about it, throws Whitey out of the ring. He's so amped up, so pumping adrenaline, so excited. He throws Whitey very hard, out through the ropes, onto the floor. Whitey lands on his shoulder. Shoulder injury keeps Whitey out of action for a year. It makes Ron Wright, this preliminary wrestler, referee, a hated villain in the market because this man hurt Whitey Caldwell. Ron has very little experience as a wrestler. Ron has no experience at being a heel. So they take Ron and they send him away. And this is when Ron goes up to work in Baltimore and Pittsburgh, and he goes over to the Carolinas some because they need him to get experience, because they know we're going to have to do something when Whitey comes back. They're not realizing it's going to be a year before Whitey can come back. So Ron goes away, starts making shots out of town, starts getting experience, starts working with veterans all over the place. And that's how you learned. Wrestling schools are great, but you can learn how to put a hold on somebody. You can learn how to do something. But you can't learn how to have a match or how to work unless you're out there with people that know how to do it in front of an audience that's going to react to what you're doing. So Ron goes away. Comes back some, refs some, but he's really never mentioned, not much said about him. Nothing said about Whitey until October the 17th, 1962. Grudge match, Whitey Caldwell versus Ron Wright as a part of this event at the Civic Auditorium, the weekly event Kingsport. Now, I'm only doing Kingsport for this podcast. Johnson City's cards were a little different. Knoxville, of course, was different because Knoxville was booked completely different than the Tri-City. So, but Kingsport's the one I've got the most history on, and it's their hometown. So the 17th of October, 62, 11 months, just shy of a couple weeks of being a full year, Whitey returns. Whitey has a grudge match with Ron. Whitey gets disqualified. They bring it back the next week. No contest. Still not the main event. Then we get to October 30th. Whitey's in a tag match. Ron's not even on the card, but they do in the newspaper mention that these men in their matches have both had, between the two of them, had to receive 22 stitches hard way in each other. How did they know about the stitches, about the injuries, about that? This is a good question. I've been asked many times about this, and I found this in my research, and I heard this from the wrestlers that were here at the time. The reporter that came every week to do the write-ups and the results, if there was an injury or if somebody went to the hospital, he would go to the hospital. He would follow them and stay to find out what had happened, to find out about the injury. So that when you read in the Kingsport papers in the 60s and 50s and 60s about injuries, they are legitimate because the reporter is there at the hospital reporting on what had happened. So they don't have a match. The end of the month, there's a couple more weeks, nothing other than the first two matches, but people want to see a finish. We saw a DQ and a no contest. Come on, man. Put them back in the ring, Mickey Barnes, local promoter. People's telling them, we got to finish this thing. So they're going to do the blow-off. They're going to take care of it. Here's what we're going to do on November 20th, almost a year to the day of the first match and the injury. Hair versus hair. Loser gets his head shaved. Whitey beats Ron. They shave Ron's head on the stage in front of everybody watching. That's the only video that survived to them. And thanks to Nancy Caldwell, I was able to put it on YouTube. It's out there for you to see. They think this is it. Now Whitey can go back to doing whatever. Ron will go back to refereeing. Ron is listed as the referee the very next week. Referee Ronald Wright. They don't understand, or they're trying to kill it off, how much heat Ron Wright has and how over Whitey Caldwell is at this point now. This legend is starting to build, and they're starting to catch fire. They're starting to become something. So, Mickey Barnes says, all right, we'll make Ron a full-time wrestler. And we'll do everything we can do with it. Now, here's a thing you need to know about Tennessee and a lot of the South in the 60s. They only booked 4 to 6 guys in a town a week. 2 singles and a tag. Sometimes it would be if they had a big main event tag match, they would book a single preliminary. But most of the time it was 4 guys. For many years, that's the way Kingsport was. 4 guys, 2 singles, they came back and tag main event. So you can't have Ron and Whitey not only wrestling each other every week, you can't have them in the same town every week. And we get into 1963, and Lester Welch takes over control of Kingsport operation March the 17th, 1963. Lester is from that mindset of the family that you don't use locals, and you sure don't push locals, even though he will become the first one to push Ron Wright. So Lester goes with the Greens and Steamboat and the girls that worked there at the time, and Herb Larson's and Eddie Graham and all the big stars that were, Len Rossi, the guys that were being used in the other parts of the territories owned by the Welch Fuller Golden Clan, Fields Clan. So he's using this mixture of stars that they have created, and they have. And Ron nor Whitey go to work for Herb Welch when he takes over. At first, it was said that he didn't want them because he had his own crew of guys and his own stars, and he didn't want local guys. And then it's been said after we get to February of 64, Ron makes his first appearance for Lester in Bristol, Tennessee. Then he doesn't wrestle in Kingsport until May the 20th. So well over a year later before Ron works the city of Kingsport after Lester takes over. Ron gets his first big push there after being in some tag matches and different stuff. His first night back, him and Johnny Long team against Rocky Smith and Sam Steamboat, two of the biggest names at the time, two of the top babyfaces in the country. Ron gets his first title win October 21st, 1964, winning the Southern title from Rocky Smith, then loses it the next week. They tried to get Whitey to come back, and it's been said by people that know that Whitey would not work for Lester Welch. He did not like him, and he did not like the way that Lester had taken the territory away from Mickey Barnes, his mentor, and from Wild Bill Caney. It takes a lot of talking with Ron Wright, talking to Whitey Caldwell, to get Whitey to come back to work. Ron and Whitey were only working in Knoxville at different times for Kazana. They weren't even working the territory up here, their home territory. But it takes some talking to get Whitey to come back. Whitey comes back March the 28th, 65. 2 years in a couple of weeks since Lester took it over. So you have to realize, in the short career and short life of Whitey Caldwell, he missed a year to an injury. He missed 2 years because he didn't want to work for Lester Welch. So that's 3 years of his career that he did not compete in the city of Kingsport, his hometown. So he definitely was not wrestling Ron every week like they try to tell you. Whitey's first night back was against another great local guy here that went all over the country and all over the world, Tiny York. Also, Tiny was from Rogersville, Tennessee, and Tiny actually went to Chicago and broke in before he came back to Tennessee and went to work here. And most of you know him as Jerry Lawler, Jim White. That's Tiny York, managed by Sam Bass. So in the summer of 65, Ron and Wright and Rocky Smith once again feuding over the title. They're switching it back and forth. Whitey's being used sporadically, preliminary matches, nothing special. Ron had a feud with Danny Hodge, with Lester Welch, with Sam Steamboat, with Herb Larson's, with Greg Peterson, and he's being featured and he's being used. Well, Whitey's not. One match that jumps out at me during this time, every time I go through it, November 21st, 1965, Whitey Caldwell is in the opening match against a young Japanese wrestler that will be known as Antonio Inoki. As Inoki was here in the Kingsport territory for a few weeks at the end of 65 into 66. So there's a little history for you. If anybody ever asked you, would Whitey of Caldwell have ever wrestled Antonio Inoki? Yes, he did. In June of 66, June the 5th of 66, Whitey finally is back full time. And he gets matches with the Wright brothers, with different partners like Bill Howard, George Grant, Johnny Higgins. Johnny Higgins turns on Whitey. They have a little series of matches. Still not getting the Ron Wright Whitey Caldwell feud like everybody thinks. But Whitey's now starting to be featured. Now he's starting to become a main event guy that he should have been long before all this, but the political stuff and all the other stuff got in the way of it. So we're into going to the end of July with Johnny Higgins and Whitey Caldwell against Ron and Don Wright. They have the big blow-off match, a handcuff match. That ends that. Then in August we get Ron and Whitey, singles match, lumberjack match, August the 10th. Then August 24th, 1966, the first ever that I can find Ron Wright versus Whitey Caldwell in what people now say Tennessee chain match. Fact versus fiction. Never was it called a Tennessee chain match here. It was called Russian Rules Chain Match. Because Ron had saw Boris Malenko and Eddie Graham do it on one of his trips into the Florida Territory and thought, man, I like this. I can do this. Me and Whitey can do this. Or me and whoever can do this. So then they come back the next week in a return Russian rules match with two referees. Then they blow it off with the Texas Death Match Labor Day weekend. Or Labor Day week of 66. So you got 4 weeks of Ron and Whitey in 1966. They had not wrestled each other in Kingsport since 1962. So 4 years. They didn't touch each other. They had tag matches a few weeks before that, but actual singles matches. So you got a little tag run, a little singles run, and then they split off. And they go off on to doing different things. October the 2nd, 1966, it's in the newspaper all around the Tri-Cities. Ron Wright is stabbed in Greenville, Tennessee in a riot. The men that were there, I've heard stories from fans. I've heard stories from the wrestlers. It is a miracle that Ron Wright lived. They were in the old VFW or American Legion Hall. It was a small place near downtown. 300-400 people's all it held. Riot breaks out. They're trying to get to the dressing room. People are hitting them with chairs. They're throwing stuff on them. A guy sticks Ron right in the back of below his neck and pulls it all the way to his tailbone. They get him in the dressing room. He has to lay on towels. They roll the towels across him. Guy on each side has the end of the towel. They're pulling it as hard as they can to hold him together. They cannot get help there. They can't get a call out to the police or an ambulance or anything else because the people are out there still throwing stuff and rioting. Somebody had to go through a window, get out of the window, run down to the police station, say, we got a man that's going to die. They get the help in, get him in there. They get him back, get him to the hospital. He's about to bleed out. How tough was Ron Wright? That is on November the 2nd, so it happened on October the 2nd was the newspaper story, so it happened on October the 1st. Ron returns to the ring November 23rd, just a few weeks later. This is returning an official match. Ron teams with Whitey for the first time on November 23rd. 1966. Ron had so much heat as a heel, almost dies. We got to turn him babyface to get some heat off of him, and we got to make some new heels. They do a thing at the Civic Auditorium. I've learned this since the book was published, where the Snakes, a new team that comes in, which one of them is Jim White. It's rumored who the other guy is. Nobody will confirm it. So we'll just say it's Jim White and his partner. They're beating on Whitey. And Ron makes the save and turns babyface, and now Ron and Whitey are a tag team. They have a feud with the Snakes and their manager General Powell. Then in August they start the year advertised as, start 1966, advertised as the Southern Tag Team Champions. That's the King Sport version. That's the belts that I have now that I've used through the whole run of Southern States Wrestling. So they start the year 67, defending the tag belts, doing all kinds of different stuff. They're in a U.S. Junior tournament, title tournament. They're creating a U.S. Junior title for East Tennessee. Even though they're the champions, they're not teaming every week because, once again, small crews. You couldn't have tag matches every week or championship matches every week. But they're still teaming and defending the belts at least once or twice a month. Ron is beloved as a babyface with Whitey. Then in July, the tournament's going on, so they're kind of in singles matches, but also in the month of July, the Dupree brothers show up with their manager, Fred White. Fred White, later known as Sam Bass. The Duprees are the Hells Angels, Chris Colt and Ronnie Dupree. Big feud with them, even having to move an event outside into the baseball stadium for Ron and Whitey to get even with Fred White and the Duprees. The Duprees leave after that. Ron is still a babyface. He's teaming on September the 18th, 67, with Chief White Eagle, who was also known as Chief Black Eagle, who Louis Torres, he wrestled all over the country. I got to know Louis at the end of his life. He was living in West Virginia because he was in West Virginia when he retired and when the territory shut down. So Ron turns on White Eagle, so he's back heel. He starts having matches with White Eagle. No mention of him and Whitey. They're not touching each other. The title belts are just dropped. Then, at the end of 67, Lester Welch had taken over the territory in 63. At the end of 67, he leaves. He leaves George Grant in control of the territory. Nobody's happy with George Grant. There's an event in the fall of 67 in Pennington Gap, Virginia, where Ron Wright, Don Wright, Whitey Caldwell, Jim White, all the guys here quit. They refused to work for George Grant anymore. George Grant had also got wrestling thrown out of the Civic Auditorium. Nobody knows what happened, what the deal was. So the territory goes dark at the end of 67. In the summer of 68... or the spring of 68, John Kazana ran Greenville, Tennessee, and Johnson City. Just the spot shows to see what they were doing. Dennis Hall was on them, and they both drew big houses because they hadn't had wrestling in months. Dennis Hall's like, hey, man, why is nobody running these towns? What this and that? Nobody knows. Nobody will talk. The local guys won't work. Dennis goes to Nashville and says, I want to run the Tri-Cities. They charged Dennis a fee to buy the rights to run the Tri-Cities and charge him a booking fee to book the talent. Dennis comes back to the Tri-Cities and opens up, and he calls Ron and Whitey and Donnie, and they don't want to work. They're happy with just working on the weekends for Kazana. They talk Ron and Whitey and Donnie back into wrestling locally, so they agree to start doing it in Kingsport, Bristol, and the spot shows, different things. And business is not good because they're not in the Civic Auditorium. They're out in the National Guard Armory. The National Guard Armory at this time is not like Kingsport now. Kingsport has grown out to where the Armory was at. But when the Armory was built, it was quite a ways out of town. People didn't like going out there, so and they couldn't get it every week. And they're trying to do the best they can do. And we get... on March the 31st of 69, they run the first event back here in the area trying to get it going. And Whitey teams up with Ray Lewis against the Wright brothers. May the 12th, 69, Les Thatcher makes his Kingsport debut. And this is about the time that they start to set Knoxville on fire with Les and Whitey against the Wrights. So Les is in for a week. He's gone. June 16th, the Wrights back with Whitey and Lewis. June 30th, Whitey Caldwell teams with Jimmy Valentine against Ron Wright and Don Wright. Here's a little history for you. Jimmy Valentine is Handsome Jimmy Valiant. That is one of the names he used before he became Valiant. And he also wrestled in Tennessee as John slash sometimes Jim McDonald. July 14th, 69, Corsica Joe and Whitey Caldwell against the Wrights. They're really not putting any thought, any booking, anything into. They're just having matches in Kingsport at this point because they're trying to rebuild a town. So they're going with the three guys that they know people want to see. And that's Whitey, Ron Wright, Don Wright. Now, August 11th, Les is back to the team with Whitey. The next week, they get a few weeks in a row, they get to run Kingsport. Whitey teams with Tiny York, Jim White as a babyface. Tiny mostly was a heel. Then Les is back the next week. Then Whitey wrestles with Dick Dunn as his partner. And during the match, Dick Dunn turns on him. So you get a couple of weeks of Whitey and Wally Dusick against Don Wright and Dick Dunn. Then Dick Dunn's gone, and Frank Morrell becomes Don Wright's partner, and they have a match in December with Whitey and Les. Then they close out the decade and the year in Kingsport on December the 18th, 69, Ron Wright versus Whitey Caldwell in the opening match of the night. And the main event that night was a battle royal. Three singles matches and a six-man battle royal. So that is a history of Ron Wright and Whitey Caldwell in the city of Kingsport. Now, they did have, from research I'm doing, they did wrestle a little more in Johnson City and, of course, Knoxville. But it, once again, never was it every week. Never was it more than probably 4 weeks in a row at a time. Because people would get tired of it. You know, they did it a few weeks and they would break them apart. And they would leave them hanging where people, well, they didn't finish. And then a few weeks down the line, one of them would say something in the interview and then the challenge is made and they're put right back together and here we go again. Then when Don Wright come along, now we got tag matches and Whitey's got different partners and different things. But probably Ron had as many matches teaming with Whitey in the city of Kingsport than he did wrestling against Whitey Caldwell in the 60s. There's so much history between those two men, and so much money was drawn in short periods of times. The chain matches became the Texas Death Match was still the blow-off for this territory. Then it would become, because of Ron and Whitey, it would become the Russian Rules chain match. And if that didn't settle it, then it became the Russian Rules chain match inside of Bullwire. And that's, if you've seen the pictures of Whitey Caldwell and Kevin Sullivan against Ron and Don from Johnson City, that's what that is, a double Russian chain match inside of Bullwire. Don Wright, one day me and Don Wright are talking, and he said, you know why we only did the chain matches once a year? And I said, to keep them special? He said, no. He said, because Whitey about killed you with them chains. He said, you would get up the next morning and you would have chain links on your elbows, your wrist, the top of your head, all the way to the bottom of your feet. He said he would beat you to death with that thing. But he expected it back. And that's the one thing about these guys. There was a lot of men, Lawler and Dundee, big time monies. Flair Steamboat, big time money. These are big markets that they're drawing people and they're coming back week after week. But they ain't hitting each other with chisels and chains every week. They ain't putting 22 stitches between the two of them in a matter of 3 weeks. They're not giving the people the blood and the guts and the gore that they come to see. And that's what they wanted to see. And you go through history like this, and I love like finding out that Antonio Inoki wrestled Whitey Caldwell. Who would ever thought that without doing the research? And in a spot show of Middlesboro, Kentucky, Bobby Shane teams with Whitey Caldwell. What a babyface tag team that would have been when he was Wonder Boy Bobby Shane against Ron and Don Wright. What a white meat baby face team that was against two rugged hill jacks that were out for blood and out to kill you. Oh, if they could have had Shane in this territory for a longer time, they could have drew big money. He passed through for 1 week and was gone. And that happened with a lot of different guys coming because it was we're kind of, you know, same distance from here to Charlotte as it is here to Nashville. So guys are traveling through. Not that far of a trip to West Virginia where there was another territory in this era. Alabama, Georgia. So, I mean, a lot of guys pass through East Tennessee would just get booked on their way through going to another territory. But Ron and Whitey left an impression. And then here we are, you know, almost 60 years later, still talking about it. Still talking about the work that they put in and the money they drew and the miles that they did on these back roads and the beatings that they laid on top of each other for the wrestling fans' enjoyment. And I take my hat off to them anytime I get into my research, anytime I get to share this kind of stuff with you. So, fact versus fiction. They did not wrestle each other every week. They wrestled each other maybe a few times a year. Yes, they were tag team champions for months together. Here's something else. Here's how dedicated they were to their product and to their keeping their business quiet. They would sit down when their kids were born, when they started having kids, they sit down and figured out the school zones in Kingsport to make sure they never lived inside the same school zone so their kids were not in school together because they were afraid if their kids became friends, people would see it and say, oh, look, it's all a put on, it's all a show. Their kids are friends. The kids did not get to know each other until around Smoky Mountain time. When Cornette brought them all together in Knoxville and they knew who they were, but they weren't friends with them. Ron actually moved out of Kingsport, moved out here into Washington County, not far from where I live now, and made sure that his kids went to county school so they were not in the Kingsport high schools with Whitey's kids. So, I mean, it's just, they went above and beyond to make you believe. They went above and beyond to make sure that you never found out the truth. And one of the sad things that I've always looked at and thought about, Ron and Don were heels when Whitey was killed in the car wreck. They couldn't go to the funeral. Childhood friends. Don Wright has told me that Whitey Caldwell was his hero because he was 9 years younger than Whitey and he'd watched Whitey when he was a kid. Whitey was a big star in high school. Then he saw Whitey's big run as a wrestler. And that was they had to keep business running and keep going. Other than Ron turning babyface for 1 week in the towns to take Whitey's place, that was the only acknowledgement that they did of Whitey's passing, where they said, we respect him, so we're going to do right by him. They had to keep a territory running, and they had to be the stars, and they had to be the stars of the Knoxville wrestling scene too. It took a large toll on them. I don't think that Don Wright really mourned the death of Whitey Caldwell until Ron Wright passed away. Then it hit him, both of them are gone, because they didn't have the time to do that when Whitey passed. They were running three towns a week, weekly, plus two spot shows, plus they were headlining Knoxville. So they had to take care of business to make sure the men that worked for them and the women that worked for them were paid and their families were paid, make sure they took care of themselves and their families. They were also doing benefit events and doing money raising for Nancy and Whitey's kids. So they never really had closure, I don't think. I don't think that Ron had closure about Whitey until the Night of Legends for Cornette. Smoky Mountain Wrestling, when they gave the award in the ring and he said what he said about him. I witnessed Donnie mourn Ron and Whitey and talk about them. And Don Wright has told me, as long as me and you are alive, Ron and Whitey are alive. Well, I want to make sure that they're alive after we're gone. That's why I do the research. That's why I do these podcasts. That's why I do the videos and anything else I can do to talk about them. They're not just a small part of Kingsport history or Johnson City history. They're a huge part of this history. They were the sports stars, the TV celebrities. They were the heroes of a generation. Same thing in Knoxville. They set attendance records in buildings that'll never be broke. People look at them fondly. But the people, the generation that saw them, are now older and starting to die out. I'm the generation after, and I've heard it, and I've did the research, but my generation is all middle-aged and older. So we got to keep the history alive. We got to keep the work that they did alive. We got to keep the fingerprints that they left for everyone to see. It's great when I see people use the term East Tennessee dog whooping, like on Facebook or Twitter. It always gets me because they know about Ron Wright. Or when the chisel comes up. There's only one territory that chisel was used in regular. Now, Ron used it everywhere he went, but I mean, it was a creation, an East Tennessee original. So, you know, Ron Wright, because of video, and there's very little of it of him, but because it's out there, he's going to be remembered mostly as a manager from his USA run and his Smoky Mountain run. There's not a lot of Don Wright out there, and I need to get some more stuff of Donnie out there that I've got. There's only one clip, that one little thing that I have out of Whitey Caldwell, but as long as we can put out there anything we find of them, we can keep them alive. And we can tell their story truthfully. Because WWE's never going to tell the Ron Wright, Whitey Caldwell story. They're never going to tell Jim White's story. They're never going to tell the Sam Bass story. They're never going to tell the Phil Golden or Bill Golden story or any other story because it doesn't suit them. Whoever lives longest writes history, and that's what we're in the middle of. We got to make sure it's wrote down. We got to make sure it's out there, and that's why I'm working in the. And I've been sidetracked for this entire year, pandemics, illness, a lot of other battles I've been fighting that people don't know about. But my goal is to get back on track and get the 50s book out, get the 70s book finished that Ron Fuller's been helping me with, let people know the rich history of East Tennessee and East Kentucky and Southwest Virginia. And how important professional wrestling is to the Appalachians. It's important enough that the Library of Congress interviewed me not once but twice this year about the importance of pro wrestling in these mountains. So I'm looking forward to getting dug back into the research and what comes out. I'm looking forward to sharing it with you. I hope you enjoyed this today. I hope you enjoyed learning about Ron Wright and Whitey Caldwell.
All right. I hope everybody learned something today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being a part of this podcast project that John Boucher and I have started, and we will continue on with both shows now. This one won't be as regular as the Outlaws to Independence, but I'll be dropping Bo James shows in where we can talk about territory wrestling, Appalachian history. I can have guests on to talk about stuff. I can do anything with this. And don't have to stay to the restrictions of Outlaws to Independence, which I love doing that too. If you would like to support these projects that John and I do, you could PayPal us, kingofkingsport@gmail.com. No donation's too small, no donation is too great. We are forever grateful for everybody that does that because these podcasts do take a lot of time and effort to record, to do the research. This podcast you just listened to, that hour or so about Ron and Whitey, That's decades of research for me. That's decades of talking to people like Ron Wright and Don Wright and Jim White and Dennis Hall and everybody else that was involved in the story that we covered today. And it takes a lot of time and effort, and it does cost John and I money to find the research and go through it and put it together, that we keep our programs very ad limited. There's very few ads that we will put on. I've got an ad that I want to leave you with where you can watch all kinds of classic wrestling through our great supporters of the Savoldi's Network, and all that description, all that information's in the description also. So they support us. We get a little bit off of everything that you do buying them. Patreon.com/KingOfKingsport if you like to hear stuff that's not shared here. And don't think that I'm going to dump the whole Patreon library over here onto the Outlaws and Independents, because that's not fair to the people that's been with me the last 5 years paying every month for the stuff that I put out over there. But I do share some of it here and some of it on the Outlaws to Independents, but not everything. So if you want to hear everything like you just heard today and get a lot of history lessons, King of Kingsport at Patreon. Patreon.com/KingOfKingsport. That's in the descriptions. Also, be back in a couple of weeks to talk to you and answer your questions. You got questions? Outlaws to Independence Facebook. Send us a message there or comment it on something. I'll make a post for questions for the mailbag there where you guys can just drop them in the comments, and we will do our best to answer every question that we get as thorough as we possibly can through our knowledge of the wrestling profession. God bless you. Thank you. I'm going to leave you with a word from Ultimate Wrestling, where you can watch all kinds of classic professional wrestling. Make sure you use Outlaws, all capital letters, when you sign up through the website. You got to sign up through the website. You get 25% off your first bill. So go ahead and make it the big one. Go for the year. It breaks down by month, less than a value meal at McDonald's, and you get all kinds of classic wrestling, TV shows, movies, all kinds of stuff on there. Here's a word. Talk to you soon.
Available on all streaming platforms, it's professional wrestling's greatest, largest, privately owned wrestling library. All the classic hits, flips, slams, and pins of yesteryear are on one place. It's Ultimate Classic Wrestling. Check out the Nature Boy Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, Mr. USA Tony Atlas, Tito Santana, Rick Martel, a who's who of professional wrestling's greatest spotlight stars ever to grace the squared circle, all in one place. Grab the best seat in the house for memories and mayhem on Ultimate Classic Wrestling.
Use the code OUTLAWS in all capital letters to get this exclusive deal through Southern States Wrestling and the Outlaws podcast. Save 25% on your first bill by signing up through the website and watch it anywhere. Promo code OUTLAWS. More information in the description.
King of Kingsport, he's larger than life. A bullwhip cracking, slicing through strife. Bo James, the king, the ruler of the ring. Veteran fighter, hear that passion sing. Where legend and grit meet. Scratched up boots and a glare so cold. Stories of battles brave and bold. Pro wrestling titan, unmatched fame. In Kingsport streets they all know his name. Where legend and grit meet. Bull
strikes the air like a storm. Swagger unmatched, his stance the norm. Crowds gather round when he rolls through town. Titan of the Southeast wears his crown. He wrestled the devils and danced through fire. A Southern hero lifting hearts higher. Hands calloused raw from the stories he carried. Bo James, the icon, Kingsport married. Where legend and grit meet. Bullwhip snaps the air like a storm. Swagger unmatched, his stance the norm. Crowds gather round when he rolls through town. Titan of the Southeast wears his crown.
Thank you.